The engine was ticking over and the propeller was just revolving. I thought of the kites I had flown, and I said to my friend, "I bet I could fly that thing." He roared with derision, and so I said, "All right, I'll show you." I looked around to see there was no one about and I got in that contraption and, to my own surprise and to the surprise of many watchers, I did fly the thing but not in the manner prescribed. My aerobatics were quite involuntary and I survived and landed safely only because I had keener reflexes than most. I was so fascinated with that highly dangerous flight that I learned to fly officially. And because I showed more than average promise as an airman, I was offered a commission in the Chinese forces. By Western standards, the style and rank granted to me was surgeon captain. After I had graduated as a pilot, the commanding officer told me to continue my studies until I had graduated also as a physician and surgeon. That was soon done, and at last, armed with quite a lot of official-looking papers, I was ready to leave Chongqing. But there came a very sad message concerning my patron, the 13th Dalai Lama, the inmost one, and so, obeying a summons, I returned to Lhasa for a very brief time. Destiny called, however, and I had to follow the dictates of those in authority above me, and so I retraced my steps onto Chongqing and then on to Shanghai. For a time I was on the reserve as an officer of the Chinese forces. The Chinese were having a most difficult time because the Japanese were trying to find an excuse to invade China. All manner of indignities were being heaped upon foreigners in the hope that the foreigners would make trouble for the government of China. Men and women were being stripped naked in public and given a body search by Japanese soldiers who said they were suspecting the foreigners of taking messages. I saw one young woman who resisted. She was stripped naked and made to stand for hours in the center of a busy street. She was truly hysterical, but every time she tried to run away, one of the sentries would prod her obscenely with a bayonet. The Chinese people watching could do nothing. They did not want an international incident. But then one old Chinese woman threw a coat to the young woman so that she could cover herself. A sentry jumped at her and with one slash cut off the arm that had thrown the coat. It amazes me now, after all I have seen, after all I have suffered, that people the world over seem to be rushing to the Japanese, offering them friendship, etc., presumably because they offer in return cheap labor. The Japanese are blight upon the earth because of their insane lust to dominate. In Shanghai I had my own private practice as a doctor, and a quite successful one too. Perhaps if the Japanese war had not started I should have made my living in Shanghai, but on the 7th of July, 1937, there was an incident at the Marco Polo Bridge. That incident really started the war. I was called up and sent to Shanghai docks to supervise the assembling of a very large three-engine aeroplane which had been stored there ready for collection by a firm which had proposed to start a passenger airline. With a friend I went to the docks and we found the aeroplane in pieces, the fuselage and the wings all separate. The undercarriage was not even connected, and the three engines were separately crated. By dint of much psychometry and even more attempts at the use of common sense, I managed to direct workers to assemble the aircraft on a very large open space. As far as I could, I checked everything over. I examined the engines, and made sure they had the right fuel and the right oil. One by one I started those engines and tried them out, let them idle and let them roar, and when I was satisfied after many adjustments that they would keep going, I taxied the three-engine plane up and down that large tract of land so that I would get used to the feel of the thing, because one doesn't stunt too long in a three-engine plane. At last I was satisfied that I understood the controls and could handle them quite well. Then with a friend who had a tremendous amount of faith in me, we got into the plane and taxied to the extreme edge of the wide open space. I had coolies put large chocks in front of the wheels with instructions to pull one on the ropes to move the chocks immediately I raised my right hand. Then I opened all three throttles so the plane roared and shook. At last I raised my hand. The chocks were pulled out and we cavorted madly across the ground. At the last moment I pulled back on the control and we went up at what I believe was a truly unorthodox angle, but we were flying, and we flew around for an hour or two to get the feel of the thing. Eventually we came back to the landing space and I was careful to note the direction of smoke. I came in slowly and landed into the wind, and I confess that I was bathed in perspiration. My friend was, too, in spite of all his faith in me. Later I was told to remove the plane to another area where it could be guarded day and night because the International Brigade was becoming very active, and some of these foreigners thought they could do just what they liked with the property of the Chinese. We did not want our big aeroplane damaged. At a secluded base the plane was altered. Much of the seating was removed and stretchers were put in on racks. At one end of the plane there was a metal table fitted and this was going to be an operating theater. We were going to do emergency operations because now at the end of I-938 the enemy were approaching the outskirts of Shanghai, and I had instructions to close my practice which I had still been carrying on part-time. I was told to take the plane to a safe area while it could be repainted all white and with a red cross. It also was to have ambulance plane painted on it in Chinese and Japanese characters. But when painted the paint was not destined to last very long. Bombs were dropping over Shanghai, the air was full of the acrid stench of explosives, full of particles of grit which stung the nostrils, irritated the eyes and scoured the paint from old Abba, as we called our aeroplane. Soon there came a greater crump and Abba jumped into the air and collapsed flat on the underside of the fuselage. An ear bomb burst had blown off the undercarriage. With immense labor and considerable ingenuity we repaired the undercarriage with lengths of split bamboo, like putting splints on a broken limb, I thought. But with the bamboo lashed firmly in place I taxied up and down the bomb-pitted ground to see how the ship would manage. It certainly seemed to be all right. We were sitting in the plane when there was a great commotion and an irate Chinese general full of pomp and self-assurance came onto our airfield surrounded by subservient members of his staff. Brusquely he ordered us to fly him to a certain destination. He would not take our statement that the plane really was not fit to fly until further repairs had been carried out. He would not accept our statement that we were an ambulance plane and were not permitted by international law to carry armed men. We argued, but his argument was stronger. He just had to say, take these men and shoot them for failing to obey military orders, and that would have been the end of us. We would have gone flying off without him. The troop of men climbed into the plane tossing out medical equipment just scattering it out of the open door to make room for their own comforts. Out went our stretchers, out went our operating table, our instruments, everything. They were just tossed away as if they were garbage and would never be wanted again. As it happened they weren't. We took off and headed toward our destination, but when some 2 hours away from our point of departure red devils came out of the sun, Japanese fighter planes, and hordes of them like a load of mosquitoes. The hated red symbol glowed brightly from the wings. They circled our ambulance plane with the red crosses so prominently displayed. And then quite callously they took turns to pump bullets in us. Since that time I have never liked the Japanese. But I was to have more fuel for the flame of my dislike in days to come. We were shot down and I was the only one left alive. I fell into about the most insalubrious place in China, sewage ditch where all the waste matter was collected. And so I fell into the sewage ditch and went all the way to the bottom, and in that incident I broke both ankles. Japanese soldiers arrived and I was dragged off to their headquarters and very, very badly treated indeed because I refused to give them any information except that I was an officer of the Chinese services. It seemed to annoy them considerably because they kicked out my teeth, pulled off all my nails, and did other unpleasant things from which I still suffer. For instance, I had hoses inserted in my body and into the water supply was put mustard and pepper. Then the taps were turned on and my body swelled enormously and tremendous damage was caused inside. That is one of the reasons I suffer so much even now, all these years later. But there is no point in going into detail because an interested person can read it all in Doctor from Lhasa. I wish more people would read that book to let them see what, well, you know what, sort of people the Japanese are. But I was sent to a prisoner of war camp for women because this was considered to be degrading. Some of the women had been captured from places like Hong Kong. Some of them were in truly shocking condition because of continual rapes. It is worth mentioning that at this time there were certain German officers, who were advising the Japanese, and these officers were always provided with the best looking of the women and the perversions. Well, I have never seen anything like it. It does seem that the Germans excel not merely at making war but at other things as well. After a time, when my ankles had healed and my nails had regrown, I managed to make an escape, and I made my slow painful way back to Chongqing. This was not yet in the hands of the Japanese, and my medical colleagues did wonders in restoring my health. My nose had been broken. Before being broken it had been, according to Western standards, somewhat squat, but now through the exigencies of surgery my nose became quite a large affair, which would have done credit to any Westerner. But war came to Chongqing, the violent war of Japanese occupation. Once again I was captured and tortured, and eventually I was again put in charge of a prison camp where I did the best I could for patients among the prisoners. Unfortunately, a senior officer was transferred from another area, and he recognized me as an escaped prisoner. All the trouble started again. I had both legs broken in two places to teach me not to escape. Then they put me on a rack and pulled my arms and legs very tight indeed. In addition, I had such a blow across the lower spinal region that grave complications were caused, which even now are making my spine degenerate, so much so that I can no longer stand upright. Once again, after my wounds healed, I managed to escape. Being in an area where I was well known, I made my way to the home of certain missionaries who were full of tuts and great exclamations of sorrow, compassion the works. They treated my wounds, gave me a narcotic and sent for the Japanese prison guards because, as they said, they wanted to protect their own mission and I was not one of them. Back in the prison camp I was so badly treated that it was feared that I should not survive, and they wanted me to survive because they were sure I had information they needed, information which I refused to give. At last it was decided that I escaped far too easily, and so I was sent to the mainland of Japan to a village near the sea, near a city called Hiroshima. I was again put in charge as medical officer of a prison camp for women, women who had been brought from Hong Kong, Shanghai, and other cities, and who were being kept there with some dim view on the part of the Japanese that they could be used as hostages when bargaining later, because the war was going very badly for the Japanese now, and the leaders knew full well that they had no hope of winning. One day there was the sound of aircraft engines, and then the ground shook and an immense pillar appeared in the distance, a pillar the shape of a mushroom with rolling clouds spreading high into the sky. About us there was utter panic. The guards scattered like scared rats, and I, ever alert for such an opportunity, vaulted over a fence and made my way down to the water's edge. A fishing boat was there empty. I managed to climb aboard and with a pull just had enough strength left to push the boat into deeper water. Then I collapsed into the stinking bilge. The boat swept out to sea on the tide which was receding, but I up to my neck in water in the bottom of the boat knew nothing about it until at last I dizzily awakened and it came back to me with a start that once again I had escaped. Painfully I dragged myself up a bit higher out of the water and looked anxiously about. The Japanese, I thought, would be sending out speedboats to capture a many-time runaway. But no, there were no boats at all in sight, but on the skyline over the city of Hiroshima was a dull, if I one red, glow, and the sky was black, and from that blackness there dropped things, blood-red splotches, sooty masses, black greasy rain. I was aching with hunger. I looked about and found a locker in the side of the bulkhead toward the bows, and in that locker there were pieces of stale fish which presumably were meant to be used as bait. They were sufficient to maintain a certain amount of life in me, and I was most grateful to the fisherman who had left them there. I lay back across the seats of the boat and felt great unease because the boat was rocking in a most strange manner. The sea itself seemed strange, there were waves of a type I had not seen before, almost as if there was an underwater earthquake. I looked about me and the impression was eerie. There was no sign of life. Normally on such a day there would have been innumerable fishing boats about because fish was the staple food of the Japanese. I felt a great sense of unease because being telepathic and clairvoyant I was obtaining remarkable impressions, so confused and so many that I just could not understand them. All the world seemed to be quiet except for a strange sighing of the wind. Then high above me I saw a plane, a very large plane. It was circling about, and through being observant I could see the large lens of an aerial camera pointing down. Obviously photographs were being taken of the area for some reason which I then did not know. Soon the plane turned about and went off beyond the range of my vision, and I was alone again. There were no birds in sight. Strange, I thought, because seabirds always came to fishing boats. But there were no other boats about either. There was no sign of life anywhere, and I had these peculiar impressions coming to my extra senses. At last I suppose I fainted because everything suddenly went black. The boat with my unconscious form drifted on into the unknown. Chapter 6. After what seemed endless days, and actually I had no idea how long it was, but after this indeterminate period I suddenly heard harsh foreign voices, and I was lifted by arms and legs and swung in an arc and let go. I landed with a splash just at the edge of the water and opened bleary eyes to find that I had reached some unknown shore. Before me I saw two men pushing frantically on the boat, and then at the last moment jumping aboard. Then sleep, or coma, claimed me again. My sensations were rather peculiar because I suddenly had the impression of swaying, and then a cessation of motion. After I was told later 5 days I returned to the land of the living and found myself in a spotlessly clean hovel which was the home of a Buddhist priest. I had been expected, he told me haltingly, for our languages were similar yet not the same, and we found difficulty in making ourselves understood. The priest was an old man and he had had dreams. He called them dreams, anyway, that he had to stay and render assistance to a great one who would come from afar. He was near death through starvation and age. His brownish-yellow face looked almost transparent, he was so undernourished, but from somewhere food was obtained and over several days my strength was built up. At last, when I was thinking that I must be making my way on through life's path, I awakened in the morning to find the old monk sitting beside me cross-legged and dead. He was stone cold, so he must have died in the early part of the night. I called in some of the people from the small hamlet in which the hovel was, and we dug a grave for him, and gave him a decent burial complete with Buddhist ceremonial. With that task done I took what scant supply of food was left and set out on my way. Walking was awful. I must have been far weaker than I had imagined because I found myself left sick and dizzy. But there was no turning back. I did not know what was happening, I did not know who was an enemy or who was a friend, not that I had had many friends in my life. So I pressed on. After what seemed to be endless miles I came to a frontier crossing. Armed men were lounging about near a frontier station, and I recognized their uniforms from pictures I had seen. They were Russians. So now I could place my location. I was on the road to Vladivostok, one of the great Russian seaports of the Far East. At the sight of me the frontier guards set great mastiffs they loose and they came snarling and slavering at me, but then, to the amazement of the guards, they jumped at me with affection because they and I recognized each other as friends. Those dogs had never been talked to telepathically before and I suppose they thought I was one of them. Anyway, they jumped all around me and welcomed me with wild yelps and barks of joy. The guards were most impressed, they thought I must have been one of them, and they took me into their guard room where they gave me food. I told them that I had escaped from the Japanese, so, as they were at war with the Japanese as well, I automatically became on their side. Next day I was offered a ride to Vladivostok so that I could look after the dogs that were being taken back to the city because they were too fierce for the guards. Gladly I accepted the offer and the dogs, and I rode in the back of a truck. After a rather bumpy ride we arrived at Vladivostok. Again I was on my own, but as I was turning away from the guard room in Vladivostok a tremendous noise of screams, howls, and snarling barks rent the air. Some of the dogs in the large compound had suddenly been afflicted with bloodlust and were attacking guards who were trying to control them. A captain came, and after hearing what his frontier men had told him he ordered me to control the dogs. By good fortune I managed to do just that, and by telepathy I got the dogs to understand that I was their friend and they would have to behave themselves. I was kept in that camp for a month while the dogs were being retrained, and when the month was over I was permitted to go on my way again. My task now was to satisfy that terrible urge I had of moving on, moving on. For a few days I hung about Vladivostok wondering how to reach the main city, Moscow. At last I learned about the Trans-Siberian Railway, but one of the dangers here was that many escapees wanted to get to Moscow, and for quite a distance by the sidings there were pits in which guards lay in wait so they could see beneath the trains and shoot off anyone clinging to the rods. At last one of the men from the Vladivostok Border Patrol with whom I had been for the last month showed me how to circumvent the guards, and so it was that I went to Voroshilov where there were no checks on the railway. I took food with me in a shoulder bag and lay in wait for a suitable train. Eventually I managed to get aboard and I lay beneath, between the wheels. Actually I tied myself to the bottom side of the railroad car floor so that I was quite high up above the axles and hidden by the grease boxes. The train started and for about 6 miles I endured being held by ropes until I decided it was safe to climb aboard one of the railroad cars. It was dark, very dark. The moon had not risen. With extreme effort I managed to slide open one of the railroad car doors and painfully climb inside. Some 4 weeks after, the train came to Noginsk, a small place about 40 miles from Moscow. Here, I thought, was the best place to get off, so I waited until the train slowed for a bend and then I dropped safely to the frozen ground. I walked on, and it was a disturbing sight indeed to see corpses beside the road, the corpses of people who had died from starvation. An elderly man, tottering in front of me, dropped to the ground. Instinctively I was about to stoop and see what I could do for him when a whispered voice came, "Stop, comrade, if you bend over him the police will think you are a looter and will shoot you. Keep on." In time I reached the center of Moscow, and was gazing up at the Lenin monument when suddenly I was felled to the ground by, I found, a blow from a rifle butt. Soviet guards were standing over me just kicking me and repeatedly kicking me to get me to rise to my feet. They questioned me, but they had such a big city accent that I was completely unable to follow what they were talking about, and at last, with 2 men guarding me, one at each side, and a 3rd man with a huge revolver poking into my spine, I was marched off. We reached a dismal building, and I was just shoved into a small room. Here I was interrogated with considerable roughness, and I gathered that there was a spy scare in Moscow and I was considered to be some sort of a spy trying to get into the Kremlin. After some hours of being kept standing in a small closet the size of a broom cupboard, a car arrived and I was taken off to the Lubyanka prison. This is the worst prison in Russia, it is the prison of tortures, the prison of death, a prison where they have their own built-in crematorium so that all the evidence of a mutilated body could be burned. At the entrance to Lubyanka, or in a small vestibule, I had to remove my shoes and go barefooted. The guards with me put thick woolen socks over their boots and then I was marched in dead silence along a dim corridor, a corridor that seemed miles long. There was no sound. A strange hiss sounded, and the guards pushed me in the back with my face against the wall. Something was put over my head so that no light could be seen. I sensed rather than felt someone passing me, and after some minutes the cloth over my head was roughly jerked away and I was pushed forward once more. After what seemed to be an impossible time a door was opened in utter silence, and I was given a very violent push in the back. I stumbled forward and fell. There were 3 steps but in the pitch darkness of the cell I could not see them, so I fell and knocked myself unconscious. Time passed with incredible slowness. At intervals there came screams ululating on the quivering air, and dying off with a gurgle. Sometime later guards came to my cell. They gestured for me to go with them. I went to speak and was smashed across the cheeks, while another guard put a finger to his lips in the universal sign of no talk. I was led out along those endless corridors again, and eventually found myself in a brilliantly lit interrogation room. Here relays of questioners asked me the same questions time after time, and when I did not vary my story 2 guards were given spatial 1 instructions, I was given an abbreviated tour of the Lubyanka. I was taken along the corridors and I was shown torture rooms with poor unfortunate wretches undergoing the tortures of the damned, both men and women. I saw such tortures, such bestial performances, that I could not dare repeat them because, knowing Western people, I know that I would be disbelieved. I was shown into a stone room which had what appeared to be stalls. From a blank wall, stone stalls extended about 3 feet from the wall, and the guards showed me how a man or woman was pushed naked into a stall with hands upon the wall in front. Then the prisoner would be shot through the back of the neck and would fall forward, and all the blood would run into a drain, and so no unnecessary mess was caused. The prisoners were naked because, according to Russian thought, there was no point in wasting clothing which could be used by the living. From that place I was hurried out along another corridor and into a place which looked like a bakehouse. I soon saw that it was not a bakehouse because bodies and pieces of bodies are being cremated. As I arrived, a very burned skeleton was being removed from a furnace and was then dumped into a great grinder which revolved and ground up the skeleton with a horrid crunching noise. The bone dust, I understood, was sent to farmers as fertilizer, as was the ashes. But there was no point in keeping on about all the tortures that I underwent. But it will suffice to say that at long last I was dragged before three high officials. They had papers in their hands which, they said, testified to the fact that I had helped influential people in Vladivostok, and another that I had helped his daughter escape from a Japanese prisoner of war camp. I was not to be killed, they told me, but would be sent to Strzyg, a city in Poland. Troops were going there from Russia and I would go with them as a prisoner, and then in Strzyg I would be deported from Poland also. Eventually, after a lot more delay because I was really too ill to be moved and so had to be given time to recover, eventually I was handed over to a corporal who had two soldiers with him. I was marched through the streets of Moscow to the railway station. The weather was freezing cold, bitterly cold, but no food was offered, although the three soldiers wandered off one at a time to get food. A big detachment of Russian soldiers came into the station, and a sergeant came across saying that the orders had been changed and I was going to Lau instead. I was loaded aboard the train, which went off with many a shudder and jolt, and at long last we arrived at the city of Kiev. Here I and some of the soldiers entered the troop carrier, to be accurate, 40 soldiers, and I were crammed into one. And then the troop carrier raced off. But our driver was too fast and too inexperienced. He caromed into a wall and the troop carrier exploded in fire from the broken fuel tank. For quite a time I was unconscious. When I did recover consciousness again, I was being carried into a hospital. Here I was x-rayed, and it was found that I had 3 broken ribs, 1 broken end had perforated my left lung. My left arm was broken in 2 places, and my left leg was broken again at the knee and at the ankle. The broken end of a soldier's bayonet had penetrated my left shoulder, only just missing a vital place. I awakened from an operation to find a fat woman doctor smacking my face to bring me back to consciousness. I saw that I was in a ward with 40 or 50 other men. The pain I had was incredible. There was nothing to ease the pain, and for quite a time I hovered between life and death. On the 22nd day of my stay in the hospital, 2 policemen came to the ward, ripped the blanket off my bed, and bawled at me, "Hurry up, you're being deported, you should have left 3 weeks ago." I was taken to Lau and told that I would have to pay for my hospital treatment by working for a year repairing and rebuilding the roads of Poland. For a month I did that, sitting beside the road breaking stones, and then because my wounds were not properly healed I collapsed coughing blood, etc., and was taken off to a hospital again. Here the doctor told me that I would have to be moved out of the hospital as I was dying, and he would get into trouble if any more prisoners died that month because he had exceeded his quota. So it was that I was deported and, once again, became a wanderer. For the first of many times I was told that I had only a little while to live, but like many times since, I did not die. Walking along a road I saw a car in distress, with a very frightened man standing beside it. Well, I knew quite a lot about cars and aircraft engines, so I stopped and found there was nothing much wrong with the car, nothing I couldn't put right, anyhow. So I managed to get it going, and he was so extremely grateful that he offered me a job. Now, that is not so strange as it may seem, because that car had passed me some time ago. We had been crossing a river bridge together, crossing just where the border guards were stationed. He had been stopped a long time, and I suppose he had been watching the pedestrians and wondering what they were doing, where they were going, anything to pass away idle moments.